Hello, everybody, and we're here again with Johan Edebo. And last time we were together, Johan, we had a conversation, I think, of remarkable intensity, opening really with we opened with a discussion of gender constructivism, but it then shifted to consideration of the mythological as a more effective communication of the real. There's more contact in the mythic than there is in the rational, was sort of where we ended that conversation. And then in the and it's an aftermath, and I was trying to put together a thumbnail, just to append to the YouTube video, and it occurred to me how your blog is actually entitled Shadowrunners. And it maybe was, oh, and I found some Shadowrunner, art, which I used as the thumbnail for the video, which I believe I entitled From the Rational to the Mythological. And Shadowrunning, or Shadowrunner, for those who may not be familiar, was a role, but I think it was originally a role-playing game that then became associated with some novels, and there's sort of video games, and there's sort of like a subculture associated with it. But I came across it in the early 90s when it was first sort of on the scene. And a lot of my friends were into role-playing games, and I've never been a big RPG guy. I've tried it out. There's Dungeons and Dragons and all the rest of it. But the only one that ever really resonated with me was Shadowrunner. Which in so many ways, as it was composed there right at the end of the 20th century, seemed prescient in its analysis of the world. And it's sort of a role-playing game that fits squarely within the genre of cyberpunk, if you like. But there were aspects of it which I thought were especially keen. Sort of the broader framework is that, yes, you have this remarkable ascent in technology. And so it takes place in 2064, I believe, is the sort of the starting date, of Shadowrunner. So in the future, but about 40 years from now. And actually now it's sort of frightening plausible. Some of the sort of the technologies that they suggest in terms of a great expansion in sort of cybernetic implants, or quote unquote enhancements, as transhumanists like to call them, and the domain of computing becomes very important. And so one way you can play in the game is by being a hacker, where you have to enter into virtual space to accomplish things that cannot be attained in the real world. So this is the early 90s, right, when the internet starting to break. But it sort of anticipates the digital, the technological, they're going to become increasingly part of the society. The state apparatuses, we know it has largely sort of eroded, and it's essentially state capital, or not state capital, but capital through the mega corporations that rule the world. And then magic, and this is, I think, actually important, magic has returned to the world. And there's a sort of gloss about how it's part of a broader sort of astronomical, and one might even say astrological phenomenon, if you want to sort of go all the way there, right? That we now are exiting what in the Shadowrun world is referred to as the fifth age, right into the sixth age. As magic returns to the world, all sorts of things happen. Indigenous people become more powerful, are able to contest their colonizers. All sorts of crazy things happen, right? And different races, elves and trolls and dwarves, suddenly become more than just stories, but become sort of incarnate realities. And all this stuff just seemed to me like it was speaking to a deep truth. And I think that the subsequent almost 30 years now, 20 to, this is about 20 some years old now, the game, the world has actually sort of vindicated the intuitions of its writers. And there's, like, there's a point of contact with the importance of the mythological, because It is a mythological construct, the mythological world. Shadow running, right? And that's the name of your blog, by the way, is a term that's variously defined, but basically you're dealing with covert or guerrilla, usually mercenary operations that are undertaken sometimes at the behest of corporations, but not merely corporations, organized crime, whatever, powerful individuals, dragons. The crazy thing is, Johan, I'm talking about this world, and I had a similar conversation actually with James Tunney a little while back. On one hand, I could say, okay, I'm just talking about, this role-playing game, this fantasy thought world that has a following and it's interesting and so forth. But I think there are actually elements of that world which have a deep truth to them. And I'm not just talking about the social prognoses or the appeal to these technologies, which are more, I'm actually talking about the element of magic. It feels like there is in fact a shift in our reality that is drawing us, and I know how this may sound to some people, but is drawing us back into an age where the magical, mysterious is going to sort of exhibit itself again in a new way. And that's fear of the fae and so on, the good people, I think is how they prefer to be termed, according to James Tunney, has relevance to how we begin to think about and navigate the questions that are in front of us. So I am going on there as I am wont to do, but I mean, you also sort of, I imagine it was almost happenstantial that you named your blog Shadow Running, but maybe you could sort of respond and talk about that or cyberpunk in general, and you could just respond to my reflections.
No, that choice of a name, Shadowrunners, is also because these narratives have resonated with me for a long time, especially the anti-authoritarian perspectives, anti-authoritarian take on science fiction, maybe. But that was an excellent introduction, I think. And let me just try to go back a little bit in time in the history of ideas, maybe. I just want to remark that Shadowrun, I would define that as cyberpunk in terms of genre, an iteration of cyberpunk. And I remember William Gibson, sort of the father of cyberpunk as a sub-genre of science fiction, was kind of annoyed with Shadowrun's introduction of fantasy of elves and orcs and all of that. He felt it was this is just Neuromancer with a bunch of fantasy thrown in. But I also think that's kind of reductive because the introduction of these sort of new age themes, this reconnection with the fantasy roots of science fiction that Shadowrun evinces is sort of it's getting back to its roots in a way. And I think as you say, it's pregnant, it connects with these deeper truths in a way. But anyway, I was reading this rereading this old Philip K. Dick short story collection yesterday, and I got to think about the meaning and role of science fiction as a phenomenon throughout the 20th century. And if we go back to, I would say, its origins in the 1800s, I think it's obvious that it served this ideological function of reproducing the narratives of progress. And I think this holds even for the precursors in earlier fantastic and utopian literature to an extent. But I mean, it's first when these kinds of literature become explicitly intertwined with science as an ideological project and this set of institutions auxiliary to industrial capitalism that I think we can really speak of science fiction in the modern sense. It doesn't really exist until it's sort of unified with this monolithic project of science. When science is truly established as this modern myth or substitute for myth, connected to progress, objectivity, rationalism, and this redemptive linear time progression that's borrowed from Christian redemption and filtered through evolutionary narratives. Then we get science fiction as this full-blown aesthetic and ideological project that sort of stands on the shoulders of this more or less complete edifice of the myth of science, of myth of scientism, and of technological redemption. And if you read, have you read much sci-fi from the early 1900s?
I can't say that I really have. I actually talked a little bit about it, again, with James Tunney. He talks a lot. Well, this is more over 19. He talks about H.G. Wells, and that's a little earlier.
But, yeah.
There's Jules Verne as well. Again, those are sort of late 19th century figures, but they
said kind of proto, yeah.
And then when you get to the early 20th century, there's some interesting crossover with early horror, I think.
Yeah, right.
You know, so probably the most famous author in that connection is Lovecraft, but there are actually lots of people in that sphere. So those are not so distant, right? The early horror and sci-fi.
No, they're kind of this romantic new romantic literature.
There's an ambivalence to the genre, though, right? Because on the one hand, it's celebrating progress in some of its iterations, but there's an undercurrent of critique, I would say. You can maybe respond positively or negatively to that.
I think it's complex. I think it's complex because I think it's not fully, we're not really dealing with science fiction until maybe the 40s and 50s, because even I think as late as the 30s, we haven't really reached this point of intertwinement between the project of science, scientism, and literature here. And there are many of these influential and famous stories that kind of operate outside of this framework of praising a monolithic science. A well-known one is The First and Last Men of Olaf Stapledon, and maybe C.S. Lewis' Space Trilogy fits in there too. And the focus is here on like values and meta-narratives far removed from the scientific ones. And they also, during this era, you kind of compete with a commingling of fantasy and science fiction, like in the original Conan pulp novels. And all of this changes kind of abruptly with the so-called golden age of science fiction. That's late 30s, early 40s. And you get this Star Trek space opera stuff where technology and science are explicitly imbued with this redemptive potential. And where I think the late modern notion of the future as this magical, mythological utopia really gets manifest in the popular mind. And Shadowrun is sort of a further step. Cyberpunk Shadowrun is a further step removed from all of this, you know. So I'm not going to go on forever, but you have this golden age of science fiction, and you have a sort of aesthetic counter-development in the new wave of sci-fi, and that begins in the 60s. And then you have authors such as Philip K. Dick, who wrote the original story behind Blade Runner. You have J.G. Ballard as prominent authors, and there's a much more dystopian focus here, much more social realism, and there's a focus on the ambiguities and the risks of technology. And there are elements of a postmodern critique of technology instead of this transformed Christian redemptive linear progression. Yeah. And that's the ground from which cyberpunk sort of springs forth, I would say.
I'm struck by what you were saying at the origin about how you resonated with the anti-authoritarian elements of Shadowrun or cyberpunk in general. And that couples onto the sort of transformation within the genre of science fiction from one to celebration to one of critique, and sort of an expose, becomes an expose of the limitations of technophilia and sort of technocentric narrative and aspiration. and how there's something sort of disfiguring. There's a disfiguring consequence, and that'll show up literally, you know, literally, like in cyberpunk, for example, the cybernetic implants will both change your appearance, but they will also render you gradually insane. And there's actually a game mechanic is used to demonstrate that. But that's just the RPG, right? It's not just in Shadowrun, it shows up in Philip K. Dick. You know, you run into things like that in Total Recall, for example, people.
Right.
You know, so the examples are multiplicitous. And so this sort of physical, it's a reflection symbolically of an intuition of the fact that in this approach to technology, we are doing something that is potentially perilous to our very being as human beings, right? Which I think is especially germane at this moment when transhumanism is exhibiting more and more cultural cachet. Now, even though you don't run into that many bona fide transhumanists, though you do, a lot of what they promote has sort of insinuated itself into relatively prosaic conceptions. And another vector of approach, we touched upon this a little bit last time, is the difficult constellation of questions that arise around trans movements. And there's a recent, it's not so recent, there are people who say that, well, that ultimately it's not just a question of moving beyond it's not just a question about moving beyond gender, but even moving beyond our own body and our own sort of concrete physical form is a limitation. They're explicit. I think Martin Rosenblatt or Roseblatt or something like that wrote a book. Let me see here. Let me get that name correctly very quickly. But you know, when you get but it might be interesting to explore, for example, on the one hand, Gibson's annoyance with the fantastical elements that you see in Shadowrun, despite the fact that in some ways there's a deep correlation there in terms of the aspirations of fantasy genre on the one hand, and the aspiration of what some sci-fi is doing on the other. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that. Here it is. I just wanted to get the name right of this text. So the irony it does not escape me that I'm okay. From Transgender to Transhuman by Martin Rothblatt is the name.
But there are many.
It's just an example.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's all. So
okay, because I think there are many many complex and intertwined themes here you raise, it feels out of my reach to really give them a proper treatment within the framework of this discussion. But something that's interesting to reflect on is how, well, the transcending of one's own body is sort of an extension of the Enlightenment theme of this Faustian expansion and the objectivity, the rationality and progress. It's sort of a self-transcendence inherent in that. And this remains also in cyberpunk, with, take the Matrix as an example. Although the you have sort of jettisoned this expansionism, and instead it's a focus, it's an immersion into technology that transforms the human self rather than an expansion into the infinite universe. And that is, I think, the main thematic shift. What? Come
Yes,
again?
that's a very interesting development that had not occurred to me personally. The difference
No,
between
I just actually, I
spatial,
just.
yeah. And, like we're just going to go insert ourselves in a server instead of going out
Right.
to explore the
That's
universe.
sort of the same. Yeah. So there's sort of this enlightenment, this Cartesian notion of the self is still stable within both of these frameworks. And have you read J.G. Ballard's Crash, or maybe seen the 96 Cronenberg film of that story? I think
No.
this is a good example of how sci-fi somehow now transcends, it moves into this critique of technology and of this immersion into technology. So it's basically it's a story about car crash fetishists and the libidinous connection to technology that's developed in the modern situation. And this kind of connects with this focus on the imminent. I would say that cyberpunk grows out of this soil and focuses the technological inner space, especially of the digital, of the cyberspace, and these kinds of things, notions developed by Gibson, as opposed to these cosmic adventures of space opera, sci-fi. And most importantly, I think the critique here of modernity is that this Faustian vision of the entire Enlightenment project somehow has collapsed. That's the point that cyberpunk is making, that this self-transcending project of modernity has failed. So you recast everything into this kind of dystopian and fruitless gaze within, into technology, into the transformed self, where, well, you're sort of preoccupied with the imminence of technology instead of the transcendent aspects of modernity. And I think this is still the basis of modern iterations of sci-fi. I see that is kind of the base note of this popular Black Mirror TV series, for instance. That's essentially cyberpunk, that basic idea of gazing within.
What occurs to me is a Blade Runner as a very sort of powerful piece that sort of sums up, I think, what you're saying. And that's a fascinating film. I almost wish they hadn't made a sequel. All right, because the fact that there's this openness at the end, I think, is part of the genius of the original, that is in a sense, or I actually haven't seen the sequel and I almost don't want to see it, right? But but if you look at Blade Runner, the film, it's based on the Philip K. Dick short story, the androids, what is it, was it androids dream of electric sheep or something like that. Like what is showing up? Is oh, there's just so much, but I'm really thinking of Decker's monologue at not Decker, the monologue at the end. I can't remember the character's name, but he is one of the synthetic, he's not actually synthetic, but these genetically modified human beings who
Skin
have been.
jobs, the replicants.
Yes,
No, they
the
are. They are.
replicants. That's right.
Yeah.
The replicant's speech at the end, which in and is so there's two things that the replicant does at the end of that film.
Oh, you mean Rutger Hauer's character?
Yes, he
Yeah.
actually exhibits a radical forgiveness and provides a sort of tie-in to the drama of human encounter, right? And actually the incredible sufficiency and miraculous quality of life itself. And that's what he's fighting for. He's fighting for a recognition of the miraculous quality of life itself. And all of this other stuff, the technology, the economy, all the rest of it is indicted as standing in confrontation with what really redeems our life as human beings.
Yeah.
and are these kinds of remarkable encounters. And the other thing that happens is that there's a relationship between Decker, the Blade Runner, and Declan, the Blade Runner, and the female replicant, whose name also escapes me at the moment, right? So it's their relationship, which is intense and which has elements that do not comport, by the way, with the dominant narrative of relational normativity. But I don't know if I have much to say concretely, but I just think as a film, it does a great job of demonstrating the power of the cyberpunk lens to indict.
It does, but I think it's an important and very interesting observation you do here at the end, because that's, I think it's very problematic that the artificial person sort of becomes in focus in this way as a vehicle for, I'm not sure how to express it, but if you read Ishiguro's recent novel, he got the Nobel Prize in Literature a few years back. It's called Clara and the Sun, and it portrays the same idea here of an artificial human being that's somehow more human than the human beings themselves. In quite a problematic way, because you return to this almost eschatological or redemptive notion of a synthetic machine that's somehow like more human than human beings, human than ourselves, a sort of a new creation of our own that's in greater harmony with life, with the life-giving divine ground of being as it's framed in Ishiguro's novel.
That's a good point, but I do want to make a qualification. Finish your point.
I think there's a risk here that it becomes sort of a marketing ploy for the technosphere in a very blunt way.
Liability. And it probably shows up. I just want to make a caveat with regard to Blade Runner in this connection. And it may seem like almost a pedantic point, but I don't think it is. The replicants in Blade Runner are genetically modified human beings. They're human beings, but they have been subjected to genetic modification so that they have artificially short lifespan. I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah, that's a hugely important distinction.
They're not.
That's not the case in the novel, I think.
Well, I think that's how I saw the movie. But it's sort of an interesting point upon which one can dwell as to the sort of specific problems that attend biotechnology. But we don't have to become detained by that distinction, because the point you raise is really a fundamental point that shows up. Like in Star Trek, you have Data, right?
Data, the greatest character.
Really synthetic. organism who's always striving to be more human. And then in the recent... Right. Picard, I watched that about a month ago. I finally watched it. Mm-hmm. And it's a deeply problematic series. I don't know if you've watched it, right? It's connected with it's entertaining, right? Now, the irony is that there's three seasons, and every season gets closer and closer to the original format. And the third season, which is probably the best season in my view, is the one which is closest to the original format relative to the other two seasons. Mm-hmm. They all actually sort of have their own idiosyncrasies, but without getting too much into it, I just want to, when I say it's incoherent, because it can't quite deal with the problem of how do you transplant consciousness, mm-hmm. which is a sort of serious issue at various moments in the narrative. But I bring up Data. Data plays an important role because Data has died. Data is destroyed at the end of Star Trek Nemesis, and his death looms as a serious part of the problem of the arc of Picard. But of course, they're able to sort of resurrect Data and and Picard is able to connect with him in a lucid dream state, where then David discloses that he has a longing for actually realizing death. Then they, you know, allow him to die, but then he gets resurrected again, and it's okay, whatever. Okay, I don't want to make too much of it, right? Okay, because you can say it is, after all, not necessarily designed to be a completely, you know, earnest reflection. But there is, you know, Data is not the only example. You see it in the androids in Star Trek, CP3O and RTD2, which aren't quite as problematic. But it reminds me of a point made, I think, by Gunther Anders about the preoccupation of Homo Faber, right? That man wants to be made and not created. The distinction between being a created being and a manufactured being, which shows up in contemporary commodity culture. And then we're reconsolidating our identity so that we're a package of commodities, because we're not satisfied with conceiving of ourselves as created or created beings, right? And this is connected to the hostility of, like, actually hostility to, like, the sexual, to sexual and sexuality and sexual engagement as a procreative, vital, and ultimately almost chaotic aspect of our life. Right. It cannot ultimately be controlled. Right. There's an attempt to sort of subject sexuality to a regimentation where it's just a kind of pleasure. It's like a narcotic or like alcohol or something like that. But it's not actually an encounter with a human being where you have to exhibit some part of yourself with a kind of vulnerability and even an animality that is, does not fit well into the notion of ourselves as manufactured robots, right? But by making the human exemplar a robot or a synthetic entity, you're stepping out of our thraldom before vital urges, which are probably most on display through sex and sexuality. I didn't think I was going to go there, but yeah, there, here we are.
That's right? That's a very interesting point, because I remember watching Star Trek when I was 5 or 6 or something, and I had this.
There's almost no real sex in Star Trek. Okay.
no, right? It's oddly puritanical in that sense, right? And I had this deep fascination with the character of Data as a synthetic being. And I can't really make sense of it, but these reflections you just made kind of gives maybe a path towards that sense making, but with some sense of an almost conceptually speaking, almost an encounter with some preternatural being. So this fascinated me a lot, because it crosses this uncanny. It's a human non-human, in a way. It's a rational non-human being.
Interesting to contrast Data with Spock, because basically, when Star Trek Generation came in mind, his character stands in and is sort of serving the function which was fulfilled by Spock in the original Star Trek.
Right,
and the Vulcan. The Vulcan as a certain archetype then actually inherits a kind of sort of darker, more critical treatment in later iterations of Star Trek. Does mature, it does get more sophisticated, I think, over the course of his various franchises or whatnot, right? And Spock himself as a character is interesting, because he's not merely Vulcan, he's half human, half Vulcan, and you feel almost as if you could not have a pure Vulcan who is so capable of completely repressing their emotionality. There's a later Vulcan, Tuvok, who shows up in Star Trek Voyager. He is a pure Vulcan. And you do see some interesting displays from him at certain points, right? And he and there's something almost repellent. And I was young, I was fascinated with Spock and found him, you know, really a compelling character.
Right.
And his, you know, logic, everything, the power of logic, right? Now I find actually McCoy a very interesting, Dr. McCoy, who always is sort of like the foil to Spock. He's like, you know, you're a blooded goblin, right? You know, he's this earthy physician, right? Who isn't sort of, who's disillusioned and isn't going to fall prey to the hubris of rationality.
Right.
It's an interesting exploration because, in different ways, these characters are all speaking to the limitations of modernity within a thought world which very much celebrates modernity. Because broadly, Star Trek is very bullish on that project.
But I wonder if not my attachment and warm feelings of sympathy towards also Spock, but also the Data character as synthetic, rational, almost preternatural beings, are connected. It's a sort of immature reception of modernity, in a sense. I wonder if you can't approach it like that.
I think you might well be onto something there, right? You might well be onto something.
Yeah, and I wonder.
You have to draw the character cue into this if we're going to like stay within the limitations of Star Trek, right? Because he sort of points them ultimately in that direction.
And I wonder if not the contemporary reception of artificial intelligence as a construct, as an idea, as a narrative, is not very much like this in many ways. That it's approached as an almost transcendent creature that's rational and logical and knowledgeable and an expression of humanity's search for self-transcendence, which is somehow also an actual counterpart, an actual subject to interact with. So there's got to be a lot of appeal. A lot of the appeal, I think, must be connected to how it expresses these myths, how it sort of becomes a concrete manifestation of these deep-rooted myths of modernity in us. Anyway. But another thing entirely, or maybe not, because I think what attracted me to cyberpunk and the anti-authoritarian potential I saw in Shadowrun as a set of narratives, I think that's connected with how it gave me this conceptual space to understand technological society as profoundly alienating. And when I realized it was alienating, I could mount this reflected resistance against it. So I think it has a remaining significant potential in just magnifying and making more real, bringing out the authenticity of the alienation, right? Like rendering it more clear and so you get an understanding of the way we are rooted and confined by these systems of technology, which at least enables us to imagine something different or imagine contradictions.
So this dystopic vision, to sort of recapitulate what you're saying to make certain that I understand it, came to have a place in your heart because it elucidates.
Yes, right.
The fact of alienation as a concrete set of circumstances.
By bounding that,
now you can deal with it. Now you have, as it were, named the demon.
Right, and the point is that this holds whether or not it goes in the direction of utopia or dystopia. It's still profoundly alienating, and that's, I think, what drew me to it, that realization inherent in that sort of framing. Kind of breaks you out of the utopia, dystopia, modernity framework.
Well, it also, as a genre, it actualizes the heroic because it seems, and you're more familiar with the genre than I am, but it seems that the heroic always displays itself in cyberpunk as rejecting that world, right? There's no, and you have degrees to which I'm thinking of, like Minority Report, and as an example there. I mean, that there's all sorts of examples that what happens is that somebody within that world rejects the terms of relationship which are being imposed, right? There's terms of relationship, right? There's always a set of prescriptions as to how you are going to be appropriately arrayed within the social matrix. You have a job, you are Thomas Anderson, not Neo. And then, of course, you get the archetype of the hacker, right? The hacker
Right, yeah.
as
Subversive.
sort of like a, I mean, I wonder what the ancient, not the ancient necessarily, but what is the antecedent archetype to the archetype of the
The
hacker?
subversive hacker, yeah.
I mean,
I mean,
maybe
you have a
to a
connection
small
to
extent,
the
the thief, it can be an archetype of sorts. You
But
know,
it's a
Rob,
trickster.
but
It's a trickster archetype,
yeah.
of course. I mean, it connects to trickster deities and so on. But I'm not sure they're really present in the human set of archetypes and that you're requesting. But
It's just a curiosity because I don't think
yeah.
there is any definite like one-to-one
I
correlation.
mean, it's you got it in Loki in Scandinavian pantheon, and I suppose you have the equivalents in the Homeric narratives. I mean, there's such a richness and complexity there. So I'm sure it's been done before,
That's true. So
But yeah, that's so
there's
cyberpunk
somehow,
sort of.
yeah,
Yeah,
go
go ahead.
on. I was gonna say the other thing that's sort of, I guess, kind of mildly encouraging is that you can have, I mean, this is something of a paradox. When you situate yourself within these kind of worlds, you can sort of start to have fun again. And I'd say it's sort of paradoxical because these worlds are dreary and dismal places, right? But it may be because they give you a kind of sense of perspectival transcendence, you're sort of
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah.
liberated from the dreariness of the dystopia. Perhaps both the dystopia they represent, but also the dystopia in which we actually find ourselves.
Right, yeah. And it's kind of allowed me to conceive of the utopia that scientific redemptionism offered us as fundamentally unfulfilling. That was sort of a very liberating notion for me in a way, I think, because it gave a voice to the unsatisfaction, the sense in which technological liberation and consumerist society did not really fundamentally respond to our deepest needs. And that, I think, it's very, I mean, that's crucially important for any sort of meaningful aesthetic or conceptual or spiritual resistance, to be able to recognize the insufficiencies of the myths we are bound by. Because if we couldn't do that, we couldn't even conceive of them as problematic, I think.
Yes. In some ways, like I was actually talking with John Stepling earlier, and we were talking about the theatrical and the theater, and this may overlap to some extent with the origins of Shadowrun as a role-playing game. And role-playing is, well, it's not theater per se, but I think there's a theatrical dimension to what's happening there. And for John, as I understand, the theater is a place where we recapture the human, and this ultimately becomes for him, as I think, also the religious, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be that these other modes of engagement, like whether through Shadowrun or otherwise, it could be an entry point to recapturing the theater as a domain of revivifying the possibility of transcendence. For a lot of people, I think transcendence is just a word. You're like, God is really actually considered to be dead by most people. But the thing is that no one's actually gone to look for the corpse, right?
No.
It sort of ties into how, like, the great, that's a mistake, actually. That's a mistake to just accept that presupposition that God is dead. Right, you have to take it seriously because it does have a cultural reality to it.
Right.
But I don't think that reality is altogether an honest reality. I think when we return to human experience, our actual encounter of the world concretely, then the divine becomes once again viable. It's not that God is dead. Is it that he is in a sense forgotten, right?
And I guess that was
I mean, to get there though, you actually have to take your own experience seriously again.
I agree, and this also resonates with the way in which cyberpunk, as I stated, I think three times that it sort of affirms the alienation, which in a sense is the affirmation of the sense in which the concrete and the sort of empty reality around us under capitalist society, under industrial capitalism, does not respond properly to my fundamental intentionality, my will, my desires. And that is, I think, is in a sense the recapturing of agency. And I think this connects very well with the role-playing game, as because that focuses and emphasizes basic human agency in a way that the consumption of entertainment can never do. A role-playing game, especially the pen and paper ones, they're essentially a social relational activity which necessitates active engagement, intentional engagement. So I think you're onto something here. And as we spoke of, on our last pod, we also spoke a lot about the need for unsupervised play for children to really develop their sense of selfhood, sense of independent agency. And that is somehow key to the problem of life in modern society in many, many ways, I think. What is alienation?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I hate to be the fly in the ointment, though, just because I'm just, on the one hand, musing as to why there's a broad resonance for role-playing games. It used to be that it was thought that role-playing games were just played by, you know, teenage pariahs in their basement together, but it's acquired a far greater attraction. So it's addressing some kind of need, but I also have to insert an apprehension about that genre, because while addressing that need, it also seems entangled with a set of commodity relations that almost sort of subverts and redirects that energy, which might otherwise be more advantageously harnessed, whether, you know, in terms of becoming more politically alive or, you know, resistant, or even in terms of like deciding what you're going to find is fulfilling in life. Not that there's anything wrong with role-playing games per se, but the I wonder sometimes if they are kind of cul-de-sac, which might say, you know, so it's a reservation I feel obliged to acknowledge.
Right, and that's
So like you also say how, you know, play and free play is absolutely necessary. Obviously, I'm completely on board with that, right? It's sort of interesting. I wonder, I don't know, you know, it's something to sort of tease out there, because I think it's muddled. Maybe I'm overthinking it.
No, I don't think you are at all, because I mean every art form or every cultural form sort of subsumed under this edifice of capitalism, it's going to be recuperated. It's going to be reduced to entertainment. It's going to be commodified. Even the most, you know, politically conscious genres and art forms will at least sort of be repackaged as stifled and neutered protest at best. So the issue is, I mean, always how to retain the critical potential in this society. And then, yeah, that's the question I guess you're going to have to constantly be asking in every situation and in every context in relation to the art form or the theory or the sort of social transformation you are seeking. I mean, how can we keep it alive in this context?
Well, I think that there has to be a willingness to be terrified. Okay, that sound.
No, yeah.
It's actually going out and doing things that are going to be unsettling to your person. Now, what do I mean by that? I'm not even talking about doing anything outrageous. I just mean, just live your life with intentionality. And I may say, unfortunately, that language has been co-opted by certain segments. Like you said, almost everything's co-opted, right? But like, for example, go drive somewhere and leave the music off in your car and just completely drive. Just that's it. That's all you're gonna do. Just do that. That can be incredibly unsettling, especially if you're not accustomed to that sort of thing. Because all of a sudden, the space of distraction, all that noise falls away, and you're confronted with certain aspects of your own life, right? I mean, actually, one thing that you learn very quickly is how much more you see when you're not allowing yourself to be distracted. You know, I did that the other day. I was almost going to check my phone, and before I started driving, I was going to like put a podcast or something. I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to drive. Okay. And I drove and I got to a red light where an exit ramp. I've been at this red light probably hundreds of times. And so there was nothing, you know, remarkable about it, except I was focused on just doing this and just doing this. And I noticed that, you know, across from the red light, there's a cemetery, and someone at one of the gravestones had left a little pinwheel, like a child's pinwheel that blows in the breeze, right? You know, and it was just like this touching sort of, you know, right? Which I would never have noticed that if I had just been permitting myself to fall into constructive distraction, listening to something wrong, right? You know, so as I do unsettling things, that's what I mean. It's unsettling. And just like acknowledge the extent to which we are all incredibly addicted. I'm addicted to these devices, these technologies. It's I find it horrifying how quickly I, you know, reach for my phone to check it and so forth. And I actively resist it, but the resistance is not altogether successful. That's just the phone is kind of the parade example, but you don't, it's more than the phones, right? It's just actually reestablishing the connection with your own interiority. You know, that happens, you know, and there's also social risks that I think, or at least there are perceived social risks to being more present with other people with a kind of insistency. To be insistently present for some people, it's going to be incredibly uncomfortable. You know, it might be uncomfortable for you, but they may not want to play that game.
Right.
Okay. They may want to just watch television. Okay. And it might become, and I mean, usually it's probably more perceived than an actual reality, but there will be situations where low level conflict will arise because the other thing that usually happens, you start losing tolerance for common modes of discourse in the, you know, right. More it's discomforting because I become exposed to my own
shortcomings,
infinitudes, and so forth. Right. That's my first response is you have to be willing to do unsettling things and countercultural things too.
Right.
It's countercultural to decide, look, I'm going to commit to this individual and I don't give a damn. And maybe it just means that maybe that project is going to be completely a failure, but that's not why I'm involved in the project. Involved in the project because I have a commitment to this individual, not because I'm trying to acquire some sort of positive outcome, right? That's just need to frame everything.
Failure or success might not be as important as the actual choice to gaze into the darkness within and without, to face the contradictions, to face the uncertainties. The outcome might be less important in terms of in the long run, so to speak. And yes. I think this is a great answer to this. whatever the question was, but this complex set of questions that sort of characterize really human culture in every situation throughout history. But the facing of the darkness, the facing of the emptiness is simultaneously, you know, also the way to build basis to reflect to because the emptiness is in a sense the absolute potentiality, the space for possibilities to reach outside of the established frameworks. And I think this also, in a way, represents what I was trying to express around cyberpunk and how it emphasizes the inherent contradictions in the dominant culture and its technological preoccupations through underscoring these contradictions. And by underscoring these contradictions, we can ask ourselves whether this kind of life is the one we really want, and we can be reminded that there is this potential for change and for entirely new experiences and ways of living.
So, yeah. So it becomes an inside job, as it were. However, I do believe that concrete political and economic decisions cascade from that commitment.
Absolutely.
Even if you don't want to become positively engaged in some sort of counterculture, your commitment to authenticity will inevitably place you in direct conflict with the dominant mm-hmm. social space. It will, and that conflict will in turn compel you to do things. You know, you won't be able to take it. You won't be able to tolerate. You won't be able to tolerate the way you used to live once you become.
No, right.
It will become just, you know, you're just unbearable, right?
Right.
That's actually ultimately a good thing. That's actually a sign that you're growing your sanity. When you start to lose your threshold, your threshold of tolerating the dishonesty. If your threshold of dishonesty is lowering, you're moving in the right direction. So, because there's just so much dishonesty in our culture right now. And I sound like some like old man there, right? But no, it's right. it's at times unbelievable the extent of lies, which is something about cyberpunk, right? It's very honest, right? There's no bullshit, right? There's no mm-hmm. bullshit in that world, right?
This also, you know, it connects with Jacques Derrida's and Mark Fisher's interpretation of Derrida's concept of ontology, and how we're in a sense haunted by the lost futures of the past, this period of the end of history and this supposed utopia where we find ourselves in. It's not the future we ordered, as I think John Michael Greer put it. And this permeates cyberpunk, but also the last 5 to 10 years of nostalgia pertaining to the 1980s, the sense in which we're being haunted by the failure of utopias of yesteryear. And that is also, to recognize this is also to come to terms with the contradictions and shortcomings of our culture, of our society and its trajectories.
It, I think, also shows up in connection with climate narrative. And mm-hmm. in my discussion with people, it seems to be increasingly the case that there is there's almost like a generational resignation among people who happen to be younger than me that I find quite disconcerting when they talk about how they conceive of their futures.
Right.
It's generally in incredibly austere terms, with the notion that everything will have to be diminished for the sake of mere survival. And this hardly seems like an attitudinal stance which is going to conduce to fruitful movement, whether on an individual basis or on a societal basis. So there's a kind of despondency that I think is very intimately connected to this climate narrative and is in sore need of address. This actually
a deep deep existential and cultural defeatism that's sort of replaced the utopianism of last many decades.
I would say, yeah. I mean, that's how I experience it personally.
I think that's entirely true. Yeah, yeah. And that started coming, I think, 2005-ish, mid double aughts, somewhere around that period. But you think this is not conducive to constructive and truthful appraisal of things?
No, I don't think it is, because I don't think it's actually honest, right? And I don't mean to put lipstick on a pig and pretend that there aren't serious problems, but if you presume that there isn't a solution, or that the solution is going to lead you down a torturous path, then you're not going to be inclined to do constructive work.
No, I think that's entirely true. And I see this severe despite, I mean, people around me that are 10 to 20 years younger seem to have their perspective is extremely bleak, and many express as a matter of fact that they have no desire to live. And that is, it's profoundly disturbing in a sense. I mean, it's just as a matter of fact, of course we don't want to live. Of course, everything is going to be horrifying. Of course, life is meaningless.
And also, it'll show with, I think, a kind of we're not going to bring children into this world. This is a terrible place,
yeah.
Right? There's a kind of muted anti-natalism. And there's a kind of, and if you don't, the thing that I've sort of started to glean is that even if you yourself don't want to have children, there's something about being involved in the process of giving life to a future in one way or the other that is connected, I think, to human fulfillment. Most right. often through, yes. And it sounds incredibly, I know, from like sounds like an incredibly conservative point, but I don't mean it conservatively. But, you know, actually, you know, engage in something like familial existence that is going to be, whether having children or planting trees that will be growing beyond your own death. That seems to me absolutely necessary to dealing with your own mortality.
But right, there's a self-giving, there's a self-transcendence, and there's a
sacrifice. Go on, I didn't kind of catch that last.
Just a parenthesis, like there's a self-transcendence, there's a sacrifice in this, which probably, as you say, are crucial to a meaningful response to the fundamental existential issues of the human condition. And also, I think they're antithetical to consumerist society in a fundamental way, because that begins and ends with consumer license and consumer desire, with no thought to the self-giving and self-sacrificial aspects of human existence. So that, I think, is and the disappearance of this mode, this perspective from the younger generations, which I think is actually the case. I think that's something we should be very worried about. Yeah.
So let me ask you this question, because this has showed up to me. This has shown up for me recently in my own life a few different ways lately, but I just and then coincidentally or providentially or serendipitously, you wrote about free speech and its significance to the digital, right? It also seems, and I may be connected to this despondency and a kind of hostile intolerance, which may be yoked to that despondency, that there's actually a rejection of free speech as a bedrock principle of radical political commitment, right? To me, if you're not committed to free speech, you're not even in the vestibule of radicality. But increasingly, I encounter people who, in many respects, hold radical views, but who have decided that free speech is dispensable. And this actually kind of leaves me gobsmacked. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that phenomenon and its potential connection to this issue of despondency or otherwise. Or you could sort of recapitulate what you were saying there in your essay about the problem of free speech in the digital.
Oh, there's much, much to say about that, but I recognize what you're talking about, and I somewhat, in a somewhat hostile manner, I sort of summarize that as an inauthenticity of their purported radical views, and it's basically just sort of a lifestyle label but that's a simplification, I think. And in relation to what we just said, I think the freedom of speech is is something necessary for the structuring and tradition of human knowledge in every way, in every sense, and in every tradition. And it's sort of also, freedom of speech is this relational opening of the space for possibilities, potentialities, and new development in relation to an infinite being, infinite world that's indispensable to avoid stagnation and indispensable to see and transcend boundaries and contradictions of our current situations. So we can't actually function without freedom of speech in some most basic sense. And there's probably a connection between this despondency and this defeatism and the rejection of freedom of speech as well, because it's obviously almost certainly predicated by fear. There's no way to, no reason to reject freedom of speech if there's not, because we fear something worse than its disappearance. And I guess the apocalyptic climate narrative and the role played, narratively speaking, by disinformation and all of that factors into the rejection of free speech, especially among the left and the ostensibly radical. So, those are my two cents on that issue, I guess. But there are also many aspects in which the digital sort of displaces freedom of speech and provides avenues for its suppression. I mean, I don't think freedom of speech can survive proliferation of the digital and the auto-moderation of algorithms, which we see now growing everywhere.
Well, I mean, what I think the crisis there almost becomes worse than that, because I think that what you actually have is not just the free speech being threatened. I think what you have is meaning itself. The mere proliferation of, like, just the unending proliferation of utterances vis-a-vis the digital and its replication, whether robotically or otherwise, sort of destroys. It's like a hyperinflation of meaning, right? Yeah. Which then destroys the words, which are their currency through which meaning is related. And so it's almost worse. It's almost worse than if you just had radical suppression, because even there, meaning would in some sense still be secure, just involved in a terrible and unnecessary struggle to assert itself. Here, even meaning seems to be at the edge of annihilation.
Yeah, absolutely so. And this also connects with the readiness of people to accept contradictory narratives because they are being purveyed by an authority or an institution whose authority you acknowledge. because that can only really take place if the loss of meaning is relatively advanced. You can only sort of stomach that kind of Orwellian doublethink if your meaning, if your notion of meaning and your understanding of meaning has been kind of dislodged. And I think that's a very, very disturbing symptom of the popular discourse today, to be honest. So how do we get away from this? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to sort of draw it back to the beginning, with the hope to sort of bringing some light into the situation, right? Maybe sort of like the world of, like, that's constructed in cyberpunk also has these interstices within which people reassert their lives as meaningful, right? In the case of Shadowrunners, you're a class or a subclass of society. They're working on its margins. But they're, and some of them are doing it out of response to just sheer circumstantial force, but many are doing it to choose a kind of freedom which isn't available within the bureaucracy.
Yes,
and,
right.
And so there's hope to be drawn from that capacity for subversion, that what you have is a human willingness to accept the difficult in exchange for freedom. And that, by the way, is the real death knell of consumerism. When people decide to put down their obsession with convenience, the consumer lure, while not then completely undone, is significantly mitigated, right? So what's exciting is that I think there's something about the human being itself that it will do that regardless, that there is something inextinguishable within human being that will ultimately reject the Isle of Circe, right? There is a point where you're like, I am incredibly comfortable, my life is embarrassingly easy, and I can't take it anymore. I have to do something more than just be coddled, right? And I think it's in our very being. And so that actually is a source, I think, of encouragement for my person. I think that the gambit of consumerism, which seeks to alienate ourselves from our own capacity for the heroic, is actually doomed to fail. Because it's going to run up against the wall of the real.
Right. I think that's an excellent summary of the entire discussion. And also, just final reflections. That was also my the notion, the affirmation of this indomitable human spirit, the indomitable human agency, or that of life itself outside of the organized society's framework. That was basically the ground note that cyberpunk as a genre struck with me, I think. So we're sort of making the same observation here, I believe.
Yes, I think so. And what did I just do? There we go. Sorry, I did something. I don't know what I did. Right. So, you know, the sun also rises. The sun also rises as the Hemingway novel notes, right? Perhaps for the moment, that's enough, just to acknowledge that the story isn't over, that, you know, that perhaps, in fact, how's the line go? The reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. Perhaps that can be, you know, said of God as well. So, but
yeah, I think that's true.
Well, I guess we can leave it there for now. Thank you, Johan. So,
thanks so much.
Is there anything else before I sign off here?
Oh, there's always so much. I have no idea where to begin. But yeah, you can also, of course, relate the notion of God's death to the to the kenosis, to the actual emptying of God and the sacrifice of Christ. So there's a whole depth, there's a whole universe of meaning to harvest from that notion, I think. Whether or not these,
I mean, that's perhaps something we could take up in a subsequent conversation. And it might also be something to consider, you know, the relationship between that and certain Buddhistic
Areas
as well. They interplay very nicely, I think. So we will leave it there.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, you too, man.
And we'll talk to you.
Yeah, take care. I'll see you.